This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wahib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
there have been diverse reactions in Cameroon after the arrests in Nigeria of 9 separatist leaders who declared the independence of the English-speaking regions of the Central African State and gave it the name Ambazonia. Some English speakers oppose the arrests, while other Cameroonians are celebrating what might be an end to a year-long crisis.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from Buwe, southwestern Cameroon. Full details coming up.
Also, Eritrea temporarily shuts down nearly 450 private businesses, the latest in a series of moves that sends shockwaves through the economy. And former Egyptian Prime Minister Ahmed Sharif announced yesterday that he would not be running for president in the country's 2018 elections, reversing a former promise to challenge Abdel Fattah el-Sisi.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, there have been diverse reactions in Cameroon after the arrest in Nigeria of 9 separatist leaders who declared the independence of the English-speaking regions of the Central African State and gave it the name Ambazonia. Some English speakers oppose the arrest, while other Cameroonians are celebrating what might be an end to a year-long crisis. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Buea, southwestern Cameroon.
Hundreds of children at the bilingual high school in Moliko have defied calls to stay at home and have returned to school for the start of the second term of Cameroon's school year. Among them is 16-year-old Glory Mbui, who says her father forced her to come to school in spite of threats from the armed separatists.
I'm afraid because they're having supporters that might continue the disorder in the country. I'm equally afraid because I'm armed to change so that I might equally continue the killing of people in the country.
The call for all children to stay at home was reiterated by the separatists after Ayuk Tabe Julius, the man they called the president of the independent state of Ambazonia, was arrested alongside 8 members of his interim government in Abuja, Nigeria, on Friday. Businessman Evaristus Njie says he supports the separatists because English-speaking Cameroonians are marginalized. He says Nigeria and Cameroon should free the arrested leaders.
The government has been claiming that they are dialoguing with them. How can they claim that they are dialoguing with them for the peace to return? Why at the same time they arrest them? It's not good. Free the Ambazonian leaders and dialogue with them for peace to return in the country.
The unrest in Cameroon began in November when English-speaking teachers and lawyers in the northwest and southwest regions, frustrated with having to work in French, took to the streets calling for reforms and greater autonomy. In October, secessionist groups declared the independence of Ambazonia and armed conflict erupted, prompting a crackdown by the military. The UN has said the violence pushed at least 7,500 English-speaking Cameroonians to flee to Nigeria. Last month, Cameroon's defense minister, Joseph Beti Asomu, visited deserted towns in the border regions and called on the population that fled to return.
The inhabitants of some of those villages has closed the border to go to Nigeria, and I want them to come back to their villages and retake their activities, their normal activities, since security has already been reestablished in all these villages.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Buea, Cameroon.
Sierra Leone marked a grim time in history over the weekend. It was on January 6, 1999, that the civil war officially arrived on the doorsteps of Freetown, Sierra Leone's capital. Rebels invaded the city and began to torture, rape, amputate limbs, and massacre the city's residents. Sierra Leone's civil war originally broke out in 1991, but until 1999 had only been taking place in rural areas of the country. The rebels wanted to overthrow the All People's Congress government at the time. After weeks of fighting in Freetown, the rebels were driven out by the members of Economic Community of West African States Monitoring Group. Nina De Vries has more on how people are feeling on this anniversary.
For Zainab Kamara, the memories are still fresh in her mind.
It was devastating. It was horrible. The sounds of machine guns. It was like hell to be. The place was like hell.
Several days after the invasion, as fighting ensued, she was standing just outside the back door of her home when she was hit by a sniper's bullet, leaving her paralyzed from the waist down. She was only 14 years old at the time and has had to use an electric wheelchair since. To this day, she doesn't know who shot her or why. She kept the bullet that was removed by a doctor.
I actually wanted to see the thing that caused me this kind of pain, this kind of terror. So they gave me the bullet and I have it with me. So I just look at it and I hold it, you know, closely to myself. And since then, I did not part with the bullet because there are times when I find things difficult, when I say things, you know, when things become so tough, I'll just look at that bullet and I'll tell myself that if I survive this bullet, then I could survive any other thing.
The country's civil war, officially declared over in 2002, left at least 50,000 people dead and thousands more displaced. And as this anniversary unfolds, others in Sierra Leone are taking time to reflect on what happened. Frank Coker remembers going out trying to find food after being in his home for several days after the invasion.
When I came out from my house, I saw, you know, people carrying dead bodies around, taking them from one point to another. You will see, maybe they will just kill someone and say you are able, because everybody was panicked. There was no trust.
Sierra Leone's Ministry of Social Welfare and Gender and Children Affairs acknowledges that the January 6th date is significant and people should not forget what happened. Department Minister Aizata Kabia says the ministry is planning psychosocial counseling specifically for those affected by the war. She says that many believe people who endured the violence are okay and have moved on from the civil war, but that's not the case. People are still traumatized, and the ministry is working to put in place a program for group therapy sessions. It will start as early as next week, she says.
We have to help souls heal, because without the individual souls healing, the nation will still be a little bit fragile, and it's our responsibility. And this, I think, was a missed opportunity right after the war, but it's never too late.
As for Kamara, she says despite what happened to her, she will keep moving forward. She has already started an organization that advocates for those with disabilities who she says can often face discrimination.
There are times I also think about, what about those that died? Where are they? Thank God I'm alive. I'm here to see this day, to commemorate this day.
A thought perhaps many will have on this January 6th anniversary. Nina De Vries, VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Eritrea has temporarily shut down nearly 450 private businesses, the latest in a series of moves that has sent shockwaves through the economy of the country. The closures were a response to companies hoarding cash and failing to do business through checks and other banking systems, according to a December 29th editorial published by Eritrea's Ministry of Information on the state-run website. Most of the affected businesses operate in the hospitality sector, according to the announcement, and they will remain closed for up to 8 months, depending on the severity of the violations. About 58,000 private businesses operate across the country, according to the government. Less than 1% were affected by the recent closures. French President Emmanuel Macron pledged to return African artifacts to their original countries in Africa while on a recent visit to Burkina Faso. He said it is unacceptable that a large part of Africa's heritage is kept in France or in private European collections and museums. However, a Paris museum that houses the largest collection of African artifacts, more than 70,000 from sub-Saharan Africa, says it would be a huge challenge to return them to laws dating back back to the 1500s that allow curators and museum staff in France to keep the artifacts. I spoke with Catherine Field in Paris about how difficult it would be for African countries to reclaim thousands of pieces that are considered their lost cultural heritage.
It will be enormously difficult. This whole question of repatriation of artifacts has come up again and again. And whilst there is this moral case for returning them, which is indisputable, you then come across French laws on returning these artifacts. Now, in particular, the one that the French government always goes back to is one that dates back to 1566, which is an edict which says that any heritage that is given to the state has to stay in state's possession. And this particular edict has been referred to again and again and again as various countries have tried to get back, whether it be your royal thrones or statues that were looted or confiscated or just the spoils of war. Now, France does admit that it has in its museums an enormous number of artifacts, particularly artifacts that were stolen or looted during the colonial wars, particularly in Benin at the end of the late 19th century. And subsequent to that, missionaries quite often were robbing communities just of little trinkets or charms. So, you know, on the one hand, you do have this acceptance by France. Yes, these are stolen, looted objects, but getting them out is more difficult. When the head of the Quai Branly, which is really the major Paris museum for African art, when he says it's an awesome challenge, he's not underestimating it at all. If you look back at some of the other cases, particularly New Zealand in the South Pacific, they asked back in 1988 that the French government return mummified heads of ancient Maori warriors. Now, they were only finally returned in 2011. So you're looking at a long period of time when the French state slowly gets round to changing laws for specific items to be returned. It's difficult job, and laws are going to have to be changed, and you're up against, on the one hand, younger people who say, yes, they should be back in their home countries. Perhaps another generation who say, well, we've looked after them this long, they're safe here, they can stay in French museums.
Well, how does President Macron, does he have a game plan? And he's looking to try to get a lot of it accomplished during his presidency.
He does want to get it done, and they are particularly looking at ways around these laws. Now, some ways around it could be, for example, if we look back, the former French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, he actually managed in 2010 to lend back to South Korea some archives that were seized by French soldiers. So he got around it by lending it back. So it's, if you like, on permanent return. So Macron could use that as a way to permanently loan them back, thereby the artifacts stay the property of the French state, but they're lent back, in particular to Benin, which is really quite at the forefront of getting their artifacts back. Another possibility that's come up, and particularly the Quai Branly Museum in Paris has suggested, that they look at perhaps the Museum of African Civilization in the Senegal, and that perhaps some of these artifacts could be lent back to that museum in that way around. And that would, if you like, get the process moving. But again, we're talking about an enormous number of artifacts. The Quai Branly has got 70,000 artifacts from sub-Saharan Africa. You've also got the Natural History Museum here in Paris, which has got, as well as various specimens of botany, they also have some 18,000 skulls which were brought to France from Africa. So even if Emmanuel Macron manages to, if you like, push the door open, you've still got so many artifacts in French museums that it will be a while, and certainly it will be a challenge to get them heading back home.
That was reporter Catherine Field speaking with me from Paris. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib. 19 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Eritrea has temporarily shut down nearly 450 private businesses, the latest in a series of moves that has sent shockwaves through the economy of the country. and French President Emmanuel Macron pledged to return African artifacts to their original countries in Africa while on a recent visit to Burkina Faso. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Egypt will hold its presidential elections between March 26th and 28th this year, the Election Commission announced today. First round results will be announced on April 2nd, and a runoff election will take place April 24th through 26th if needed. Yesterday, former Egyptian Prime Minister Ahmed Shafik announced that he would not be running for president in the country's 2018 elections, reversing a former promise to challenge Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who was widely expected to win.
The office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights deplores the recent executions in Egypt of 20 men on terrorist-related charges. Lisa Schlein reports from the High Commissioner's office in Geneva.
Five men were hanged in Alexandria on January 2nd. 1 week earlier, on December 26th, 15 men reportedly were hanged in two prisons in the rest of Sinai region. All were tried in military courts and found guilty of acts of terrorism. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Liz Throssell says her office is deeply shocked by these executions. She says it is unlikely these men received a fair trial, as military courts typically deny defendants' rights accorded in civilian courts.
In cases of capital punishment, trials must meet the high standards of fairness and due process. Reports also indicated that the prisoners who were executed may have been subjected to initial enforced disappearance and torture before being tried. Despite the security challenges facing Egypt, in particular in Sinai, executions should not be used as a means to combat terrorism.
Four of the men executed in Alexandria were convicted in relation to an explosion near a stadium in 2015 that killed three military recruits and injured two others. The 15 men hanged on December 26th were found guilty by a military court of killing several soldiers in Sinai in 2013. Throssell says civilians should be tried in military or special courts only in exceptional cases. Under these circumstances, she says defendants must receive a fair and public hearing by an independent and impartial tribunal. She says everyone charged with a criminal offense must be presumed innocent until proven guilty. She adds these guarantees appear to have been denied to the 20 men recently executed by Egyptian authorities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Arab foreign ministers met in the Jordanian capital Amman Saturday to discuss the dispute over President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And in Saudi Arabia, the government has arrested 11 princes for protesting a decision to stop paying their electricity bills. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Arab news channels interrupted their usual coverage to focus on the Arab foreign minister's press conference in the Jordanian capital, which is the latest development in the ongoing controversy over the decision by U.S. President Donald Trump to move the American embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Arab League head Ahmed Abul Ghait told journalists that the guiding principle of Arab diplomacy regarding the Jerusalem controversy, in his view, was to preserve the legal status quo. He says that no final decision has been reached about what to do, but the main goal of Arab diplomacy is to reduce any Palestinian losses or Israeli victories resulting from the U.S. decision. Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi, who hosted the gathering of the Egyptian, Saudi, Jordanian, and Moroccan foreign ministers, told journalists that the position of Jordan is to push for international recognition of a Palestinian state.
سنسعى الآن للحصول على قرار سياسي دولي عالمي للاعتراف بالدولة الفلسطينية على خطوط 4 حزيران 67.
He says that the Jordanian position is to seek an international political decision to recognize a Palestinian state within the borders prior to June 4, 1967, with Jerusalem as its capital. He adds that all efforts will be made as well to prevent other countries from following the U.S. example and moving their embassies to Jerusalem. Safadi, in response to a journalist's question, later insisted that his country was not contemplating canceling its peace accord with Israel over the matter. He stressed that the best way to resolve the conflict is to pressure the international community to block the U.S. decision and to push for a two-state solution entailing the recognition of a Palestinian state.
واستطعنا أن نخرج ببعض الاقتراحات مهمة فيما يتعلق بالعمل المشترك للتصدي لهذا القرار الأمريكي.
Saudi Foreign Minister Adel Jubeir told journalists that he and his fellow foreign ministers had discussed what collective action to take to support the Palestinians in rebutting the U.S. decision and ultimately resolving the Israeli-Arab conflict. Jubeir also said that Arab foreign ministers discussed the ongoing regional conflicts in Syria, Yemen, and Libya, along with Iranian meddling in the region.
وجدد وزير الثقافة والإعلام امتنانه للقيادة الرشيدة إثر ضخها نحو 30 مليارا.
In other regional developments, Saudi Arabia offered financial incentives to a number of groups, including government workers and the military, following recent price increases on fuel and certain staples, according to Saudi Culture and Information Minister Awad Al-Awad. The Saudi Daily Al-Okaz reported that 11 princes from the ruling Saud family were arrested for protesting a government decision to stop paying their electricity bills. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Justin Thwaites, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
Hello,
sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.